Tape's on? Okay. Start. Good afternoon to the assembled throngs in room 15 of the Capitol. This is the Judiciary Finance Division, and we're going to do some budget overviews today. We're going to start with Minnesota Tax Court. So I suspect we have some members of the Tax Court with us. Please come on forward. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Latz, member of the committee.
Yes.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm Joanne Turner. I'm the incoming chief judge of the Minnesota Tax Court, and with me today are the other members of the court, our outgoing chief judge, Brad De La Pena, who was just reappointed by Governor Dayton to another six-year term, and Judge Thomas Haluska, the newest member of the court. Also with us and backbenching is Lisa Peister, our longtime court administrator. Our presentation today will do two things. First, we'll explain briefly what the tax court is and what we do. Judge Haluska will take that. And then second, Judge De La Pena will take that task, and then Judge Haluska and I will provide the background and motivation for our budget requests for the 2016-17 biennium. Judge De La Pena.
Mr. Chairman, Judge, committee
welcome.
Members.
Just before you jump in, let me just make a note for all of the assembled members of the public here that we're not going to be taking any public testimony. These are just budget overviews. And when the committee considers the actual decisions on the budget, we'll have public testimony at that time. All right. Thank you. Go ahead, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, the court's basic function is to adjudicate two classes of cases. The first is disputes between property owners and counties about the value and classification of real property. Those disputes involve everything from private homes to industrial facilities to office buildings. The second class of cases is appeals of orders from the Commissioner of Revenue. Those disputes involve all of the tax types that the Commissioner administers, including corporate and individual income taxes, sales and use taxes, and various excise taxes such as cigarettes and gasoline. The court is an expert and independent agency of the executive branch. It is expert in that the court's three judges are selected based on their expertise in tax law. The court is independent in two distinct and important ways. First, it's independent of the governor. Once judges are appointed and confirmed, they serve fixed terms and are not subject to removal by the governor. Second, the court is independent of taxing agencies. The court reviews final orders of counties and the Commissioner of Revenue rather than making recommendations to those taxing authorities as a standard administrative court would do. The court's expertise guarantees that taxpayers have access to judges who understand the often complex state and federal tax laws. The court's independence allows it to serve as an effective check on taxing authorities. Indeed, the court's basic function is to determine whether taxing authorities have correctly enforced legislatively determined tax policies. I have two additional points by way of background. First, the court is accessible to taxpayers. In the tax court, actions are commenced by filing simple one-page forms. That's true in both property and Commissioner of Revenue cases. Second, informa pauperis status is available to qualifying taxpayers, and in those cases, filing fees are waived and the proceedings are paid for by the court. The court also provides foreign language interpreters when necessary. Where more modest amounts are in dispute, taxpayers can file in the court's small claims division. It's a more modest filing fee, and there are no formal records of proceedings.
Sorry, Judge, there's a small claims division within the tax court?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. There are jurisdictional limits, as there are in small claims division in the district courts. It's a more modest filing fee. It is not a matter of record, and the tax court's decision is final and unreviewable. So it's a more inexpensive way to resolve a dispute.
Is it the same judges that hear the small claims cases?
Mr. Chairman, it is.
Okay, so there's no appeal from the small claims to some other full body of the tax court. It's basically the same procedure. It's just a jurisdictional limit and smaller filing fee?
That's correct, sir.
Thank you.
The last point I'd like to make is
Judge,
that
Senator Newman has a question.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Your Honor, what are the jurisdictional limits of small claims division?
The current jurisdictional limit is $5,000 in commissioner cases. In property tax cases, it's items of value under $300,000. I'll note by way of sidebar that we have asked for an increase on the policy side of an increase in that jurisdictional amount on the commissioner side, because we think that the efficiency of and the lesser expense of small claims matters is a benefit to taxpayers that they should enjoy in a broader class of cases.
And what's your increase request?
Chairman Latz, we've asked that it be increased to match the jurisdictional limit on conciliation court cases in district court, which in a commissioner case would be about $10,000. Our jurisdictional limit in a small claims commissioner appeal hasn't been increased since about 1987.
Okay. You think $10,000 would be enough? I think small claims conciliation is going up to $15,000 at some point, isn't it? Is it on a staged increase?
Yeah, all that we're asking is that it match whatever the current the jurisdictional limit is in conciliation court and district court. Originally, those two tracked together. Okay. At some point, the jurisdictional limit on the judicial branch side increased, but because ours is set by statute, it never got changed. And so at some point, we'll be asking that those two again track together.
Has there been separate legislation drafted and introduced to do that?
Chairman Latz, that's pending review at the governor's office. We haven't had any indication that there's any resistance to it within the governor's office. It's just a matter of getting it over here and jacketed. It has been drafted.
Okay. We'll watch for it. Thank you. Go ahead,
Mr. Chairman, my final point is that the tax court is extensively used by taxpayers. The court's filings by number increased about 300% since 2000. From approximately 1,200 cases, there were 6,000 cases filed in 2010. The number is slightly reduced now. And I'll note that the court's statutory filing fees, which go directly into the general fund, more than fund the court's operations. And with that background, I'll turn it back over to Judge Turner.
Thank you, Judge Delpina. Judge Turner.
Chairman Latz, we have three budget change requests for consideration. First, we're asking for an increase in our base budget to meet statutory requirements. Second, we're asking for one-time funds to replace our case management system, and Judge Haluska will discuss that request in more detail. And finally, we're asking for funds to hire a third judicial law clerk. I'll start with the request for an increase in our base budget. The purpose of that increase, again, is to continue to provide services that we are by statute required to do and to pay the things that you, the legislature, have required us to pay. You've got a slide in your packet which shows our current biennial budget by category. You'll see that the vast majority of our budget is dedicated to the payment of rent and salaries, none of which is under our control. Judges' salaries are set by statute at 98.52% of the salary of a district court judge. The salaries of our three administrative staff are negotiated with their respective unions and bargaining units, and the salaries of our law clerks are determined by management and budget based on their job classification, and our rent is established by the Department of Administration. You've also got a slide that then breaks our budget out between fixed and other costs. And you'll see that if you take out fixed costs, we've got about $50,000 left, actually a little under $50,000, to pay for everything else we have to do. What's on that list? Postage, IT services, long-distance calls, travel, The three judges of the court are required to hear cases in all 87 counties at the taxpayer's option. Paper for the copier, office supplies, replacing computers when they fail, keeping our library and reference materials current. In addition, we're required by statute to pay for transcripts and other out-of-pocket costs for indigent taxpayers. We're required to pay for interpreters for taxpayers who could not otherwise participate in the proceeding. As Judge De La Pena indicated, our caseload has increased about three times between 2000 and 2010, the peak year of filings. That increase in the number of filings, particularly on the property tax side, created a significant backlog of cases. We discussed that backlog when we met with the committee 2 years ago in the last budget cycle. Since then, the three of us have made some significant progress in reducing that backlog and in putting cases on a path toward timely resolution. But that has taxed our infrastructure beyond its limits. And our focus then in the next 2 years is in reducing the backlog and addressing those infrastructure inadequacies. As I've indicated, the number of new cases being filed is down, but still above historical averages. When I talk about infrastructure, I'm talking primarily about our case management system, which Judge Haluska will discuss in more detail, but briefly. Case management system is the repository for everything we know about the cases that are pending before us, who the parties are, when the case was filed, who represents them, and everything else, everything that has happened in the case since it was filed with us. Without a functioning case management system, we don't know. We have no way to know what cases are pending before us or their status. If cases are our inventory, a case management system is our inventory management system. The first budget change item I want to discuss with you is a request for an increase in our base budget, and that's been triggered by several requirements. First, the court has historically used an outside technology consultant for our IT-related work. And that's everything from installing and configuring our new computers to fixing our systems when they crash, fixing our server when it crashes, fixing our email when it crashes, installing software. A few years ago, you, the legislature, required that all executive branch agencies consolidate their IT work within a single state agency, which is known as MNIT, MN.IT. Our turn at moving our IT work to MNIT will come in the next biennium. And as a result of that transition, our IT costs will increase from about $13,000 a year to about $57,000 a year. That's a $44,000 increase. Those aren't our figures. They come from MNIT. What do we get for that $44,000 increase? MNIT will take over managing our email, will take over managing our server. It will provide help, a help desk, which now we pay hourly as we need. In addition, there are two one-time projects that are triggered by the shift to MNIT. First, MNIT will take over operation and maintenance of our website, which hasn't been updated in, well, since it went up. That's a one-time cost of about $40,000 for MNIT to assume maintenance of the website and to reconfigure it to suit MNIT's purposes. That's an important project for the following reason. Our cases are not published by West in any printed volume. They appear on Westlaw and Lexis, but you have to pay to get them from Westlaw and Lexis. The only place you can get our cases for free is our website. And that makes it a critical resource for taxpayers who are unrepresented by counsel and who are appearing before us. It's the only place they can go to find out what we have decided in the past.
Judge Turner, is that...
Chairman Lance.
That large increase for a MNIT, does that include the upgrading of the website?
It does not.
So this is just the ongoing maintenance and operation that they're increasing it dramatically.
Yes, Senator.
For.
That's That's ongoing maintenance. It includes ongoing maintenance of the website. It includes desktop support. Now, I don't want anyone to think that we could get by with less money if we were willing to accept a lower level of service from Mint. We certainly asked about that. It turns out, as it has been explained to us, Mint ranks service outages based on the number of users affected. There are only 8 of us in the court, counting the judges and all the staff and the 2 law clerks. With only 8 users, it doesn't matter what our problem is, no matter how bad it is. We will never be more than Mint's lowest level of service, which means Mint promises that it will try to look at the problem within 5 business days. Not actually fix it, just try to get to us within 5 business days. And for that, we'll pay about $800 a month, about $10,000 a year toward desktop support. That's included in that $44,000.
So why the big increase over your current IT expenditures?
We can give you the numbers we got from Mint, but it's basically taking over everything that we have been paying on an hourly basis to this point. So they will take over our email access, maintaining our server.
But why should that cost you 5 times as much or whatever the number is?
Chairman Latz, as it has been explained to us, up to now we pay for that stuff on an hourly basis. We only pay for it when we need it. But as I understand it, Mint will, in effect, allocate a portion of a staff member to us, and we will pay a portion of the cost of that staff member, whether we use that staff member or not.
Something's wrong with this picture. Senator Newman?
Mr. Chairman, I agree. I suspect that Judge Turner really doesn't have the answer to these questions. But given the fact that the tax court is here asking for us to increase their budget in order to cover that cost, maybe it would be appropriate to ask Mint to come in and justify why it is costing the tax court 5 times more money for the same, I assume the same level of service.
Minute has to say.
So would I, Senator Newman.
Now, it included in that number, Chairman, as well. For example, there are things that Minute will require us to do that aren't in Minute's own number. So, for example, we'll be required to replace a quarter of our hardware every year. Although we don't pay Minute for that, we have to include it in the budget. And I've included it in that $44,000 increase because now we don't do that. We don't replace stuff on that kind of a cycle. It will include maintenance of our website. That's another $6,000 a year, and again, we've been paying for that just as it crashed. In addition, there's one important piece of software, our case management system, that Mint will not assume responsibility for. It's 15 years old, and it's not worth it for Mint to try to learn how to keep it running. And so for that, we'll have to continue to pay our outside consultant.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. I would also like to ask Mint, and I want to confirm that I heard this right, that it could take up to 5 business days if you have a crash or an issue. It could take up to 5 business days for them to fix it or respond.
Chairman Lance.
That's Judge an awful Turner. Long time.
It is a long time, Senator Dietzick, particularly because by statute we're required to issue our decisions within 3 months. If we come up to that deadline, there is no provision in there's a provision in statute that allows us to extend that deadline in the case of a death or illness or the consent of the parties. Hardware and software crashes aren't covered by the statute, although we certainly expect that our parties would be understanding, our litigants would be understanding.
Okay, but that would put the tax court in the awkward position of seeking the acceptance of the parties while you go ahead and fail to comply with the statutory law of the state of Minnesota.
They would have us by the short hairs, Chairman Lance. Yeah. Also included in our request for continuation of our core operations We're asking for funds to cover salary increases. Again, our salaries are a percentage of the salaries paid to a district court judge. The judicial branch has asked for a 5% increase for their judges. If that goes through, or whatever the increase is, we will have to cover that increase as well. And increases in salaries for our staff, which are negotiated at the state level. We're projecting that those increases would be 3% for staff, again, 5% for judges based on the judicial branch's request. That would be about $34,000 in fiscal 16 and about $65,000 in fiscal 17. And obviously, with only $50,000 after fixed costs, we can't cover those increases out of the money we have now. We're also trying to plan ahead for things. One of our staff members will reach retirement age in the next biennium. She'll be entitled under her union contract to pay out of whatever accumulated vacation she has and 40% of her accumulated sick leave. So we're trying to budget for that eventuality. And then the other and final reason for our request for an increase in base budget is to cover the things that, again, we are statutorily required to do, like provide interpreters and transcripts for indigent taxpayers. In addition, as I've indicated, taxpayers entitled to have the case tried in the county in which the property is located or the county in which the taxpayer resides. So we travel to all 87 counties to hear cases. Since in the 2 years I've been on the court, I've been to Rochester, Winona. I've tried cases in Otter Tail, in Crow Wing County. Judge De La Pena has spent a good amount of time in Itasca County. So we're trying to budget for those travel expenses as well. And again, now that the court is fully staffed, to the extent we've been able to cover those expenses in the past through judicial salary savings, those salary savings are just no longer available to us. Our second budget change item covers replacement of our case management system, and Judge Haluska will talk about that.
Judge Haluska, welcome.
Senator Latz, members of the committee. As Judge Turner indicated, our primary infrastructure is our case management system. It's the way that we know what we're doing and when we're supposed to be doing it. Our current case management system is circa 1999. It is no longer supported by the vendor that we received it from. And it won't operate on any current Windows operating system that is supported by Windows. Essentially, what we've done through our IT person, not Minute's IT person, but our IT person, is to jury-rig the system so that we're still operating with a case management system that keeps track of our records. If it takes a dive, then, you know, we're essentially done. We're back to just doing everything by hand, although when I go on, I'll show you that we do a lot of stuff by hand here anyways with the case management system that we have. At the time that we got the case management system, we were handling about 1,200 cases a year. Since then, we've had a high of 5870. Currently, in 2014, it was 3483. Our case management system does not communicate with the district courts. And what that means for us is that our property tax filings are in all 87 counties. They're filed with each district court. They're entered into the district court's case management system. So they're already entered in once with the district court by the various district court personnel in each of the counties. Almost all of our filings, that's about 3,000 to 5,000 cases, depending on what year we're talking about, what we do is we receive brief written summaries from the various district courts as to what was filed and when. These are then entered by hand in our case management system. So we can't electronically communicate with the district courts and have a dump of their information into our system. What we do is we get a printout from them, which we then turn around and enter into our system by hand. Uh, And the other part of that problem is because we have this difference, we don't necessarily get all of the cases that are filed. So, for instance, last year we discovered through the fact that we received settlements, notice of settlements or notices of dismissal, that there were 150 cases that weren't in our system at all, that we had never been notified of. As I said, our case management system is incapable of talking with the court. So once it comes to us, it comes as paper, we have to enter it, and then because of the age of the system, all subsequent filings are done by paper and then hand-entered. This is going to create another problem with us with our interface with the district courts when the district courts goes to a complete e-filing system, which, as I understand it, they're planning on doing in July of 2016 for all their district courts. The other problems that we have with our current case management system is it creates limited reports. In all routine documents that you would generally think would be that could be generated by a case management system, we still have to do those by hand. So, for instance, if we want to do notices of hearings or trials, you would generally think a case management system would be able to spit all of that stuff out. We're sitting there doing this by hand. Now the cost is, and this is a cost estimate that we received from Minute, is $1.4 million in one-time funds over the next biennium. There would be ongoing annual charges that Minute estimates to be about $144,000. $84,000 of that it would be a charge from Minute for hosting an additional Minute support for the system itself, with the balance being possible ongoing fees charged by the vendor. This would be for licensing and essentially reserved for what if we had a problem with our system or needed some sort of special configuration, the charges that the vendor would charge as opposed to what Minute could provide us. Now, we have started the process of looking for a new system. What we've done is we have used money that we have saved from the current biennium, and we've hired a consultant to help us review existing case management systems and to prepare a selection criteria, one that would allow us to communicate with the district courts, that would allow us to accommodate e-filing, and if you grant our request for funding for our case management system, we hope to be in a position to move forward quickly and to be able to match the timing of the district courts in going to e-filing. Judge Turner?
Judge Turner.
Chairman Lantz, our third and final budget request is relatively small, $85,000 a year each of the next 2 years to hire a third law clerk. During the last budget cycle, the legislature gave us funds for Westlaw and to hire two law clerks, which the court had never had before. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We have put that money to great use and hired two terrific law clerks, but there are only two of them, and there are three of us. So we're asking for funds to hire a third clerk, which would allow each of us to have essentially a dedicated clerk. There are two additional slides in your packet showing our workload. Because there are no jury trials in our court, we have to issue written findings of fact and conclusions of law, a supporting memorandum in each case we decide. The law clerks help us do that. They do basic legal research. They confirm the facts of the case. They cross-check and double-check those against the factual record. And they also double-check us on the law. They research cases and make sure that our decisions are legally correct. And that has done a great deal to reduce our backlog. The final slide in your packet shows our court budget compared to the fees that our cases generate. And as you can see, although we don't entirely pay for ourselves anymore, or we come pretty close to paying for ourselves, even with the requested increase in base that we're asking for, we will still be funding a substantial portion of our budget through the fees that are generated by our cases. And by the way, those fees go into the general fund. They are not dedicated funds. Our litigants also, just as an aside, pay the $2 court technology fee, although we're not eligible to seek grants from that fund. And with that, Chairman Latz, we'd be happy to respond to any questions by the committee.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee that we haven't already asked? All right. I think we will probably have some additional discussion and likely invite Minute to come here and help us understand the basis for your dramatic IT cost increase. Maybe you'd be willing to come back time that they come to help us flesh out that whole question. Judge Turner?
We'd be more than happy to and look forward to the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your service and your presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Department of Corrections, while they're getting prepared, I will note to the members that given the volume of the bills that we see every session, and especially this year, budget year, meetings are going to probably begin running longer than the hour and a half that's usually allotted to this committee. So we'll let you know ahead of time when we're expecting that so you can schedule accordingly, but don't be surprised. If you start doing that, we're going to make absolutely every effort to avoid evening hearings if we can possibly do that. But you should expect in March, especially as we get closer to deadlines and on deadline days, that we'll be here for a good portion of those Fridays. So we'll plan to leave town on Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Department of Corrections.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, Commissioner Roy.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Roy. I'm Commissioner of Corrections. To my right is Lisa Wojcik, Assistant Commissioner of Corrections and Operations. I'm going to do some introductory slides, and then we'll move into the substance of our budget, and we're going to keep it as concise as possible and as understandable as possible. We always try to give a brief overview of our department. I think the members that are here have seen this before, so I will be very quick. Minnesota falls about in the middle in terms of state population. We descend to 49th lowest in general fund expenditures on corrections, about half of the national average. Because we have such a low prison population, 49th, we also have a very low correctional staff as a percent of workforce, also half. And the new statistic that you folks might not have seen is that our corrections industry program employs a lot of people, and we are third in the nation in percentage of inmates that are productively working. We are a large agency because of our 24/7 365 operation. Around the clock requires lots of employees in our 10 prisons, lots of square footage to manage, over 10,000 adults, 120 juveniles, and those juveniles primarily in our Red Wing facility. We have a tremendous churn, C-H-U-R-N, of offenders in the front door and out the back door, and that intake and release process takes a lot of resources. And once they are released from prison, they are on community supervision. The department provides that supervision out of 14 statewide district offices, and currently about 20,000 offenders on supervision. This statistic shows that we are successful with a large number of offenders and that they don't commit new felonies. However, this statistic is a bit deceiving, and I am obligated to tell you why it is deceiving. Those felon offenders often commit new misdemeanors, and this statistic does not take that into account, nor does it take into account technical violations. When those two factors are worked in, we hover around 50% recidivism.
Commissioner, we should note that before you get to the point of a commit to state prison, except in some except in some instances, you have to have a bit of a criminal history before you get there. So you've already established some kind of a pattern of committing crimes, either misdemeanors, grosses, or felonies, before you get to the point of being committed to the state prison system. So when you say a 50% recidivism rate, it seems to me that's you're expecting a lifestyle change from folks when they leave prison, and to achieve within 3 years at least a 50% lifestyle change, a rate of change, that's pretty good. How does that compare with the national?
We, Mr. Chair, we've fallen to the average zone. There are, it's really tough to compare other states, and that's been a real challenge for our national organizations to come up with a common definition. Many states send people to prison that we don't. So when they keep those people out of prison, for instance, their prison rates go down and they look very good. Actually, you prefaced our slide number 6 here just perfectly. We will look at that immediately since you brought it up, that drug offenders do have significant felony convictions on an average, although lots of drug offenders come into prison without any criminal history as well. Property offenders, and these are averages, and of course there's outliers to all of these statistics, but this particular graph very clearly demonstrates the weight that the Minnesota sentencing guidelines put on person offenders, that person offenders tend to get in prison quicker because of the ranking of the crimes. Property offenders, not so likely. And going back to slide 5, the results of criminal behavior and violators and people getting prison sanctions, we've had a steady creep of prison population over the years. We have tried to explain this, and just an hour ago, the House Committee asked me if there's any single explanation for why people continue to, why the prison population continues to grow, and is there any single reason for that? And I said that we have analyzed all of these intakes, and there really is no specific offense or person type. It's just a general rising. Mandatory sentences are getting longer, and if you have longer sentences, and older people with more criminal history, you get a creep in prison population.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Way, going back to slide 3, it states that you have, if I've got this right, over 10,000 incarcerated at the time. We have 10 prisons in the state. Is that true?
We have 10 facilities, 9 prisons.
Can you tell me the population of the largest, which prison that is, has the largest, what that population is, and the smallest?
Our Faribault prison, almost 2,000, 2,200, and the smallest prison would be Oak Park Heights at about 450,
okay.
Our supermax.
Thank you.
So if we move on to slide number 7, this is how we fall in the big state picture. We are part of the public safety and judiciary 5%. And this committee, of course, is familiar with that budget. And of that budget, we are at 2.4%. And when we move on to slide 8, this defines our department in our major funding categories. Obviously, institutions are the majority of our budget. Our community services, traditionally called probation and parole. And then of that budget, a pretty significant amount that has drawn some attention is the $144 million that passes through to the counties for the very important work that they do in probation and parole supervision. And then as a large organization, our operations support budget is very, very important to us. But I think the bottom graph shows that we are totally committed to spending the money where we ought to spend the money, and that is in our mission. And our mission is related to offender control and programming and supervising. Our budget challenges, because of the nature of our business, it's a 24/7, 365 operation. We have no ability to control who comes to us. If a judge says we take somebody in prison, we do that. If the judge says we take somebody on probation, we do that. We are a heavy general fund department, number one in the state. And because federal pass-throughs don't exist, like in transportation and human services, we depend on the state budget for our operations. We have a dynamic with our correctional employee retirement plan that's been in existence for many, many years. It covers a lot of our employees, and it's not dissimilar to police and fire plans, but it is a statutorily defined pension plan. Moving on to the next slide, the governor's recommendations, and these have been distilled down from obviously a long list that we had presented to the governor, and we have, at the end of the day, come forward with these important initiatives. The agency operating costs are the bulk of our requests, and this keeps us in business. These are salaries and benefits, all the things that keep the business of corrections operating. We have also are requesting increases in community supervision funding, and we will detail all of these in a bit later in the presentation. Our offender health care is also very important to us, and the legislative auditor last year noted some concerns, and we're addressing those concerns with this budget increase. We find ourselves, like many other departments in the state, facing obsolescence in our technologies, primarily our computer systems. And we also think that catching bad guys who have gone on the lam is very important, and we're going to be asking for increases in our fugitive apprehension unit. The next slides will be presented by Lisa Wojcik, our assistant commissioner, who is a budget guru.
Commissioner Wojcik.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lisa Wojcik, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. This first change item is actually our largest, a total of $34.2 million for the biennium. And essentially, it covers our staff compensation costs and a transition to state-operated food services. It maintains our current staffing levels. This is not to increase our staff for the compensation purposes. It's just our existing staff. It assumes a 3% increase for community services and institutions, and a 1.8% increase for operation support. In essence, it equates to about 260 employees. So if we don't get this funding, we would most likely have to lay off about 260 employees. And with this, there's a 4% vacancy rate assumed for the entire agency.
And Commissioner, that 4% vacancy rate has been maintained for a number of years now, right?
Mr. Chair, this year we're actually only at a 3% vacancy rate. We're funded at a 3% vacancy rate. In the past 5 years, it has gone from close to 7% to 3%. And it has been solely based on how much money we've had. It's incredibly dangerous for us to be operating at a 7% vacancy rate, and I, in my humble opinion, believe a 4% is pushing it. 3% is fairly natural for us in the amount of time it takes to fill positions and just through natural attrition. 4%, we actually have to leave positions vacant in order to reach that. We have to make decisions to leave certain positions open to do that.
So 2 years ago, during the budget presentation, do you recall what the vacancy rate was then?
What we budgeted our vacancy rate at, or what our actual vacancy rate was?
Okay, both.
2 years ago, I believe, is when we had close to that 7% vacancy rate by budget. So we were forced to reach that level of a vacancy rate. Not every unit or facility was able to do that. So sometimes we had to borrow money from one institution to help bail another institution out.
Actually, that was pretty quick.
For 20 minutes.
Our next change item is for technology modernization and obsolescence. Right now, we are in a position where we rely very heavily on technology, of course, and we have an offender management system called COMS, which is the Correctional Operations Management System. Technology outdates and expires, and we are running up against a deadline at the end of this year and another one 5 years out. And with our current staffing levels, we are unable to rewrite all the background and code we need to rewrite for the system to be operational. So why is this really important to us? So this is the system that we use to manage all offender data and all offender activity. This is what, when an offender comes in the system, all of his data is entered into this database. It's actually multiple databases. So we use this to provide staff in the prisons the number of inmates they have in their prisons so they can do counts. We do all of our offender sentence administration, so we're releasing the right offender on the right day. If these systems fail, we are going to be in critical danger. We also use the system to communicate with other state agencies, public safety, human services, DEED. We also share information with federal agencies, the courts, and local law enforcement. This is an absolute need for the agency, because if we don't have our technology, we're in kind of deep doo-doo, which I think you kind of heard from the courts a little bit, too.
I have a question on that point. Aside from your technological reference or your dependence on technology to keep track of dockets and when to release dates, you have backup for this type of thing? Annual backup, maybe? Or what happens if you had a lightning bolt and it shut your power off? What would happen?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Wojcik.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer. We actually have many redundancies built into our systems. So with our partners in Minute, we actually have data storage not only within our agency, but we are moving towards more data storage within Minute as the state is moving towards those data centers, which has lots of built-in backups. But we do have many internal processes built up, and we also have emergency plans. Continuity of operations plannings for what we do when we do have technology crashes, so to say.
So, Mr. Chair, your dependence on your primary technology, you claim, is getting taxed or needs updating, and despite the fact that you do have a redundancy plan, that chances are we may not make a mistake with someone's sentence release date. So I just want to make sure of that, so that we're not going to the shoebox and looking up the date of when we're supposed to release someone.
Commissioner Wojcik.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, we actually have not only technology for sentence administration, but we have human beings audit prior to our releasing of any offender, because we think that is of critical importance.
Don't just have note cards, huh?
Don't tell.
It's all along one wall at Commissioner Roy's office. It's
the abacus.
Chair. Thought the library card catalogs went away.
Mr. Chair.
They went over to DOC.
When I was a correction officer about 30 years ago, we had very large ledger books. And we had, at that time, this was in Hennepin County, we had computer salesmen that would continually come and try and analyze the system of booking, trying to determine how
what kind of computer program was necessary to make a corrections booking system go high-tech. And I remember the salesman bringing in the suitcase-size Osborne computer that you could only see a quarter of a 8.5 by 11 page, and you'd have to scroll to the next quadrant of the page to look at it. But so we've come a long way, but technology always needs to be replaced. But that was one of my functions, was to write in by hand prisoner names and when their release date was. And I never wanted to make a mistake on a date, because that is the biggest no-no you can ever do in the expectation of someone wanting to get out at their appointed time.
I see your handwriting, Senator Limmer. How did you manage to not make a mistake?
You found my weakness, Mr. Yes. Chair. Yeah.
All right, Commissioner.
Only ever knew.
Mr.
Go ahead. Whoever's next, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my name is Terry Carlson, and I am the Deputy Commissioner of the Facilities Division. I'm going to be taking the next couple of slides along with Nanette Larson, who will be presenting in just a moment. The next topic area is health care, and the Department of Corrections, of course, is required to provide professional health care to all of our incarcerated offenders. We have several initiatives that Nan will be talking about in a few moments, but they relate to compliance issues with the Minnesota Olmstead Plan, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, the recommendations from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, accreditation standards, and many other statutory requirements. And at this time, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Nanette.
Thank you, Larson. Terry. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Nan Larson. I'm the Health Services Director for the Department of Corrections. And I think most of you know about our prison system and how we provide health care, so I was going to do a little bit of background, and I'm not. I'm just going to jump right into this. So as you can see, our offender population, just like the community, is aging. Our population is not a very healthy population, so a 55-year-old is going to look like a 75-year-old or 70-year-old. With, you know, risky behaviors comes poor health. Oftentimes our offenders also don't have a lot of primary care when they're on the outside. So sometimes they're seeing our providers for the very first time. Our offender population, we do have some acute illnesses, such as dialysis. We also get cancers. We can't choose who we take. We have to pretty much take whoever is sentenced to us. That means paraplegics and quadriplegics and whatever conditions they may or may not have, we have to be able to manage them on site. The first part of our healthcare initiative is the funding of an electronic health record. The electronic health record, of course, will ensure compliance with state and federal mandates, which went into effect in January 1 of 2015. We continue to use a paper record, which makes things pretty difficult for our providers to share. Our mental health providers might be on one side of the institution and our medical providers on the other, and they can't access the record simultaneously. So an EHR will help to alleviate that problem. And EHR will also help to help us comply with the Olmstead Plan. And I don't know if all of you are familiar with Olmstead, but it has to do with a lawsuit that was brought by parents of a disabled child. The state has an eight-agency statewide Olmstead Plan to help persons who are disabled be housed in least restrictive environments in a very client-centered environment. And, of course, an EHR will help us share information and do comprehensive release planning. 95% of our offenders will be leaving us and will be out in the community. And the EHR will allow us to better share information with our community providers. An EHR will also allow us to share information with our jail partners. As you all know, we get our offenders from the jail, and we switch them back and forth quite regularly. And EHR will really help us to maintain that continuity of care between jails and prison. The second aspect of our healthcare initiative has to do with expanding medical and nursing services. This will allow us to expand nursing care to 24-hour nursing care, to three new sites. We currently have 24-hour nursing at two of our facilities, and so this will allow us to expand to Shakopee, our female facility, Lino Lakes, one of our medium custody facilities, and then Stillwater, our close custody facility. It will also allow us to provide more nursing triaging for our offender population, so improving access to nursing care. It will allow us to enhance our chemical dependency release planning. There is a study that clearly indicated if you receive aftercare after completing prison-based CD treatment, that it will help to reduce recidivism by about 44%. So we think that this release planning, comprehensive release planning, will certainly enhance public safety. And then, of course, it also helps us to address the concerns that were raised in the legislative auditor's report, such as managing our chronic care conditions, doing intake physicals in a timely manner, and then continuity of care as we're transferring our offender population between our facilities.
Senator Lemmer.
I had a quick question. Going back to your population, one-third of your population has chronic care needs. Do you know how that compares to the general population?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Lemmer, it's really going to vary based on the disease that you're talking about. But, for example, let's take hepatitis C. Probably 10 to 12 to 15% of our population is hepatitis C positive. If you look in the general population, you're looking at about 1%. So it really depends on diseases. We have a fairly high diagnosis of diabetes in our system. We have a fairly high rate of HIV, even though Minnesota doesn't have a very high rate of HIV, but we have anywhere between 50 and 60 offenders at any given time who are HIV positive.
And, Mr. Chair, Ms. Larson, with that type of concentration of chronic, specific chronic conditions, does your nurse coverage need to be specialized in any way, or can a general RN satisfy, or do you have doctors on staff? Maybe you could fill me in on what level of nursing you need.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lemmer, we run outpatient clinics in all of our institutions very similar to what you would go to. So initially the request is triaged by nursing staff, and they make a determination whether or not it's something they can handle through standing orders or whether or not they need to see a physician. And we have physicians on site at all of our institutions, some 5 days a week, some 3 days a week, depending on the population and which facility you're talking about. We also use nurse practitioners and physician assistants as primary care providers. So we use a very similar model to what you or I would access.
And one other question. On your 24-hour nursing coverage, does that require just one person on staff most of the time, let's say on a graveyard shift, or do you need to have more than one?
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lemmer, we would have two staff at any given time, just to be safe. We want to have an RN because an RN can do assessments, and then we would generally have an LPN as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead, Ms. Larson.
That's it.
Okay,
you're
let's
done.
Move on to the next slide.
Commissioner Carlson, go ahead.
Thank you. The next topic area is our Fugitive Apprehension Unit, and I'm going to have Ms. Gerlicher come up and talk about our request in that area.
Mr. Chair and Committee, my name is Carrie Gerlicher. I'm the Director of the Investigative Unit with the Minnesota Department of Corrections, the Chief Law Enforcement Officer. You'll see in the next two slides that we've had an increase in high volume of warrants that have been issued for the arrest of DOC offenders over the last several years. When I first started with the Department of Corrections in 2001 as the director of the investigative unit, on a daily basis, we would average anywhere from 180 to 200 active warrants for DOC offenders on any given day. Obviously, those warrants rotate as one person's arrested, another warrant may be issued. And we've started to notice in the last 18 months as our offender population grows, more offenders are being released. Obviously, some are doing very well in the community, but others will continue to violate. Our warrant numbers continue to increase. So on any given day in the last 4 months, our warrant populations have sat around 350 to 400 active warrants on a given day. In calendar year 2013, over 5,100 warrants for our offenders were issued.
detention.
Those offenders are brought back into custody either by my fugitive unit. Some of them will turn themselves into their agents, or we have other law enforcement agencies in this state as well as across the country that assist us in apprehending these fugitives. You can see just in the issuance of level 3 sex offender warrants, so these are level 3 sex offenders that currently are on supervised release or intensive supervised release within the state, a 16% increase in warrants from fiscal year 2010 to 2014. In calendar year 2009, there were 66 warrants issued for level 3 sex offenders in the community. In calendar year 2014, there were 203 of them. So the fugitive unit, at the request of the governor, and one of the goals for our agent is to make sure that level 3 sex offenders, as well as offenders with warrants who have a history of loss of life, so murder or manslaughter, are taken back into custody within 72 hours of the issuance of the warrant. And I'm happy to be able to say that with those 203 warrants in calendar year 2014, 98.5 of them were arrested within 72 hours. That means that my 5 licensed peace officers are on the street a lot. That means that we have 24/7 coverage. If an agent issues a warrant at 2 o'clock in the morning, Oak Park Heights will call me at 2 in the morning, and I've got people on the street within the next 45 minutes of that warrant execution. And the numbers are continuing to increase, which means if we're paying the majority of our attention to level 3 sex offenders and loss of life warrants, then other warrants aren't getting a whole lot of attention paid to them. We will continue to have our effective partnerships with other local law enforcement agencies in the state. For an example, one of the projects that we've had now for about 10 years is Minneapolis Police Department loans me an officer for what they call a 4-month career enrichment program. Twice a year, the summertime hours for Minneapolis are too busy for them to spare an officer, but in the fall and in the winter, they send me an officer. They come work for me for about 120 to 160 days. We teach them the art of fugitive apprehension. They spend some time in the city of Minneapolis, but we also get them out and about the state, other metro areas, and all over the state so that they have access to our intelligence investigators, they have access to our analysts, and then when we're done with that career enrichment, they go back to Minneapolis, and they can continue working in the city of Minneapolis with fugitive apprehension using my tools. It's been a very successful endeavor for both the city of Minneapolis as well as my agency. You'll see the funding request, fiscal year 16, $541,000, and fiscal year 17, $670,000. The first year, we are asking for 2 sworn officers. With only 5 officers on the street on any given day, the ability to field training officer 3 of them at a time would really be extensive and probably a bit exhausting for my current officers. So we're looking to start 2 of them starting in this coming fiscal year and then the 3rd one in the last fiscal year. We're also asking for 1 corrections intelligence investigator. I currently have 1 intelligence investigator working for me full-time. Her responsibility is to work with the fugitive team, to go out on databases and websites, to listen to inmate phone calls, to take a look at where money came from when this offender was incarcerated, all of those intelligence pieces, and then give the fugitive investigators on the street ideas for places to go to look for these warranted fugitives. She also spends quite a bit of time reaching out to outside law enforcement agencies when we believe that a fugitive is out of state. So, for example, if we get information that a fugitive is somewhere in West Virginia, obviously I can't send 2 investigators to West Virginia. It's not cost-effective for the state. So she will contact West Virginia and send officers out to the location that she's identified in that area. She's responsible for anywhere from 25 to 30 arrests on her own with out-state fugitives on any given year. And then the third area that we're looking for additional staff for is a support staff that's going to help the creation and the ongoing collection of level 3 database information. We came to the state about 6 years ago to ask for 2 positions to start working on what we call level 3 database files. So about 90 days before an offender is released from prison with an end of confinement review of a level 3 sex offender, I have an investigator and an analyst that will take a look at this offender. They'll take a look at who they've spoken to. They take a look at who they communicate with in the community. They take a look at where they got money from. They'll go in and interview this individual so that at 2 o'clock in the morning, When that warrant goes out, because this offender has violated their release status, my investigators can immediately pull up a file that's already been put together. It's also updated about every 90 days as they live violation-free in the community. So usually within the first 90 minutes to 2 hours, we have five locations for my fugitive team to start looking for bodies. What we found before the creation of this unit was that these investigators were getting up at 2 in the morning or getting up at noon whenever the call comes out, and they're spending the first 5 to 6 hours just trying to pull data on this level 3 sex offender to find the best places to go. So one of the reasons that we have such a high arrest rate with these individuals is because we have a really good solid base of information as to where to start looking for them. Well, as the number of level 3 sex offenders being released into the community continues to increase, obviously that information that my investigators need to gather increases, and quite frankly, we're falling behind. So we're having some level 3 sex offenders today released into the community without that pile of information that's so critical to their apprehension. So now we're actually kind of having to start to triage which ones we think it's more important to get a file on than others. And so far, our triaging has been accurate, but I'm not looking for the day that triaging was not accurate. When I get a call at 2 in the morning and we have a sex offender loose somewhere in the community and I have no information to go on, and they have to start from scratch. So you'll see that the funding will allow, hopefully, for us to continue to make more arrests, for us to provide quicker and more reliable intelligence information, not only to my investigators on the street, but to law enforcement across the state and across the country. Two of my investigators also work on a daily basis with the U.S. Marshals. We have a great working relationship with the U.S. Marshals. In fact, two U.S. Marshals are going down to Costa Rica to pick up one of our level 2 sex offenders as we speak. It improves officer safety, not just for my investigators, but again for law enforcement at large. Outside law enforcement are calling my intelligence investigators quite frequently and asking for updates on offenders. And it's also going to continue to increase our ability to participate in warrant sweeps. Historically, we have tried to participate in 3 or 4 out-state warrant sweeps every year. And unfortunately, in the last 12 months, we have been so inundated with level 3 sex offense cases that we have not had the ability or the time to put together comprehensive warrant sweeps. And we want to get back into the business of going to Duluth with a group of 4 or 5 people, or to Moorhead, or to Austin, or to Rochester, and spend 2 or 3 days in those communities helping them pick up their warrants. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm open to any questions.
So I think I heard the answer to my question in your comments, but you were talking about the increase of level 3 sex offenders who are subject to warrant. And I believe you said it's probably related to the fact that there are more level 3s being released directly into the community. Is that right, or is there some other explanation that's embedded in there somewhere too?
No, Mr. Chair, that would be accurate. As more sex offenders are given a level 3 release status, and they're being released into the community, as those numbers continue to increase, obviously some of them are very successful, but it also leads to the reality that some of them are not successful. And so when they are having either violations because they violated their release agreement, which is the most common reason for a warrant to be put on actually any offender, you know, they're caught drinking or they're not checking in with their agent, doesn't necessarily mean that a new felony law has been violated. When those warrants are increasing as agents are more involved in the behavior of their clients.
Are you also seeing persons labeled level 3 that in the past might have been level 2, or is that analogous to grade inflation, or is there a real...
Mr. Chair, I'm gonna have to answer that more highly with a population increase. I sit on one of our end of confinement review committees and have for many, many years, and there is a very strict tool that's used by our psychologists in the prison system where they do a very strong calculated process as to who comes out with a level 1, 2, or 3 sex offense. The reality is, just as our population in general increases, some of those inmates that are adding to our population are sex offenders, and so I think you would see that there are more level 1, 2, or 3 sex offenders across the board being released back into the community.
Chair.
Senator Lemon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you turn the slides back a little bit to where you are comparing? Yeah, that one. I see 97% of fugitive level level three sex offenders are apprehended within 72 hours. The percentages don't give me a real indication of the numbers of level three sex offenders that are actually departing from their conditions of supervisory release. Do you have that number of what the actual numbers are when you, let's say, in the last year or 2 years?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer. So for an example, in 2014, calendar year 2014, there were warrants issued for 203 level three sex offenders.
Out of how many?
How many sex offenders in the population in general? I'm not sure if I have that statistic with me. I can get it for you. The data that I have are arrest data, and I don't have just level threes in the community, but I can get that for you. 200 of them are arrested, but I will get that data for you, sir.
And one other question that I had is on...
I wanted to hear the answer to your first question, Senator Woman.
I thought she had answered.
So of the 200, how many of them were...
Of the 203, Mr. Chair, that had warrants issued against them, 200 of them were arrested and within that 72-hour time frame. That's 98.5%. The question that Senator Limmer has, I believe, is how many sex offenders are in the population on any given day, period,
mm-hmm.
and how many... So, Senator Limmer, sometimes there may be duplicate warrants on an offender. For example, there may be a warrant issued in January. We pick them up the next day. They get restructured. They go back into the community. There may be another warrant issued for them in April. But I will get you a general population total in 2014 as to how many level three sex offenders were in the community.
Another question I had was those that are in this classification being subject to arrest, how many of those are subject to the arrest for the reason of reoffending a sexual offense?
I could probably answer that.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the recidivism rate for Minnesota sex offenders is about 3 to 4%.
And, Mr. Chair...
For new criminal sexual conduct.
Yeah. Commissioner, would that be at the same level? What do you know what level of sexual offense that would be? Do you have that broken down?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer... The Sentencing Guidelines Commission has the exact numbers of those sentenced and for what category of sex offense, and it's a very detailed report that my old mind cannot answer your question for.
Mr. Chair, when we talk of reoffending in any criminal class, let's just limit it to personal crime, would you find that 3% is representative of the non-sexual offense of reoffending, or would that be something sizably different?
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the best performing offenders under supervision are murderers. The second best performing group of offenders are sex offenders, and it declines from there. Property offenders, burglary, check writers have the worst recidivism rates. Burglars are especially bad.
Mr. Chair, when I think of a murderer that is being released, I'm not sure if they have any treatment model that they're required to participate in. Maybe they are, but it certainly would be different from any treatment program that a sex offender of that level three, would be going under in order to qualify for a supervised release. Is there I'm trying to compare at that low of a rate, does treatment models, are they more effective in the correction system than those that are not? And under these two offenses, is there any difference or a comparison that one could extrapolate between the two classes?
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the treatment availability for murder cases is pretty significant, and a lot of those offenders over the course of time in prison have completed, many of them, everything we have available. Some of those releasees need continuing support after treatment, and many of them end up in halfway houses, AA involvement, support groups, circles of support. And it's a pretty labor-intensive activity for those being released on murder. Similarly, and the problem with sex offenders is that the word completion of treatment is very difficult for a lot of people to grasp. We see a successful treatment of a sex offender in prison as an active participation and progression through the phases of treatment. And at the end of their confinement, they may very well continue that treatment in the community. And there's a lots of notion about or dialogue about offenders having to complete treatment, and the discipline is moving away from using that word to more of an active participation. And it can vary by the quality, the type of sex offenders. Some are, it's tough to talk about sex offenders generically because they range from 85-year-old grandpa to the 16-year-old on the back of the school bus to the predator in the alley. There really is an inconsistent profile, and the success rate differs significantly for those different profiles. There are many, many sex offenders that never come to prison. They're doing short-term local treatment in community corrections facilities, and recidivism rates 0 to 1%. And I think I got everything you were asking.
I think you did, Chair.
I just want to note we've got about 10 minutes to go.
I'll hold my question.
We've got three change items left to go through, and I do want to hear something from the department relating to you're contracting with local jails for housing inmates, and your thoughts on doing less of that in the future with an increased population coming in.
Mr. Chair, some of that discussion will come with Mr. Solheid, who is sitting on my right, Deputy Commissioner Ron Solheid.
Mr. Solheid.
Mr. Chair, my name is Ron Solheid, Deputy Commissioner of the Community Services Division at the Department of Corrections. There we go. The slide that we have showing on the screen right now basically shows you that there are three correctional delivery systems in Minnesota. The Department of Corrections provides felony supervision in 55 counties of the state. We also provide misdemeanor and juvenile adult misdemeanor and juvenile supervision in 28 of those counties. The Community Corrections Act counties comprise 32 counties. There are 17 CCA jurisdictions around the state, and they account for all of the correctional supervision in their counties. And then there are the county probation offices, which provide supervision to adult misdemeanors and juveniles in 27 counties. The next slide that you have shows that essentially the budget for probation and supervised release at the Department of Corrections at the top. We supervise approximately 18,000 offenders, just under 20,000 offenders, about almost 18,000 on probation and about 1,500 on supervised release, or also known as parole. The Community Corrections Act counties supervise approximately 80,000 offenders within their jurisdictions. And then the county probation offices supervise approximately 14,000 offenders that are misdemeanors, adult misdemeanors and juveniles. The next slide kind of focuses on the crux of our budget increase here, our initiative. Dealing with intensive supervised release or ISR supervision. under statute, caseloads for ISR offenders are 30 offenders to two agents. Intensive supervision involves many more contacts, both in the community, collateral contacts, as well as office visits. A higher level of supervision also includes GPS monitoring, stepped-up drug and alcohol monitoring as well with these offenders. Level 3 offenders are making up a greater proportion of the caseloads for our ISR agents in the community. In 2009, there were approximately 50 Level 3 offenders on ISR supervision, and a snapshot in December of this year, we had 197 Level 3 offenders on ISR supervision. Part of that growth is accounted for as statutory changes have required lifetime ISR supervision for the Level 3 offenders, so that will continue to grow. And that we don't know exactly what that trajectory looks like at the present time, but it will continue to grow. The other portion of our request involves the Challenge Incarceration Program, or the boot camp program. We have increased the capacity for phase one, which is the boot camp itself, by 45 beds. This results in another 90 offenders in being released into the community for phase two and three supervision in the community, which is 6 months for each of those phases. So we need a couple of additional agents to account for this. On this slide, you'll note that there are more than 95,000 offenders supervised by the counties. The Community Corrections Act counties comprise about 70 to 75% of the state's supervision population, as well as the larger metropolitan areas of the state. They provide probation and parole supervision to the adult felons, misdemeanants, and juvenile offenders. And then the county probation offices, the 27 participating counties, provide primarily misdemeanant and juvenile supervision. It's a different funding stream or pass-through dollars to the county probation offices than it is to the Community Corrections Act counties. The initiative included in the governor's budget is $3 million each year to go to community supervision. And what we've done is we've broken this out to $1 million each year to add additional ISR agents. In the DOC, we supervise ISR offenders in 75 counties, and Community Corrections Act agencies supervise the ISR offenders in 12 counties of the state. So we do, in essence, contract with those Community Corrections Act agencies to provide for that ISR supervision, so it's pass-through dollars, essentially, for that supervision. And so this will add up to as many as 10 agents, 3 for the DOC and 7 for the CCA jurisdictions that are doing ISR supervision. It will help us comply with the statutory requirements as far as the mandatory caseload sizes. It also increases funding for up to $250,000 each year to add 2.5 FTEs for the CIP supervision, which the state essentially covers, the DOC covers statewide. It increases funding for the Community Corrections Act subsidy of $1.55 million, which equates to essentially a 4% annual increase to the CCA subsidy funds. It also increases funding for county probation officer reimbursement, $200,000 each year, which also equates to a 4% increase to that reimbursement pool.
To summarize the requests, we have increase in community supervision, making our communities safer, and recognizing the importance of our county partners to increase the pass-through money to them. Offender health care is a concern to us. The legislative auditor did a very comprehensive report of our health care system, and we are addressing those very important concerns that were raised there. The technology improvements, the archaic systems that we are dealing with, need attention. We are married to those systems, and we just have to take care of that marriage. fugitive apprehension. Ms. Gerlicher made a very compelling case for that. And agency operations, of course, take care of our existing system and what it takes to run 10 prisons and staff all of those prisons and probation officers in the community. We really hope that we are focusing on the important need of public safety, and we hope that we get your support. Thank you.
Commissioner, could you address the question of housing inmates in the counties and the projections for dealing with those as well?
I think it would be wise to look at the graph that showed our prison increase and our strategy for dealing with our current capacity issues is to contract with local jails. In the state of Minnesota, there are a tremendous number of jail beds that are vacant, and we have seen that in the meantime, for probably the next year or two, that the county jails can accommodate our approximately 400 overpopulation prisoners. Those prisoners are short-term violators. They are usually prisoners that don't have any acute health problems or mental health problems. They are usually prisoners who don't make trouble for the county jails, to put it very simply. We like not to have people do long terms in the county jails, under a year, hopefully. We recognize that county jails are a tough place to do time. Programming is usually not equated to our prisons. The work opportunities don't exist in those county jails. Sometimes those jails are not close to family, and we fully recognize that this can't go on forever. We are seeking and developing alternatives to control the flow in the prisons, trying to develop strategies for those return violators, those very short time people that are coming back into our prisons. And we are also exploring some potential options to release people to more creative programming at the end of prison. We currently have some early release programs, work release, CIP, and as you heard in Mr. Solheid's presentation, we have increased the beds in our challenge incarceration program, our boot camp. We also recognize the importance of adjusting sentencing guidelines. The sentencing guidelines, especially the mandatory minimum sentences at zero criminal history, there are a fair number, and we estimate 200 to 300 people come into our facilities first time criminal activity with a mandatory prison sentence. Judges are departing downward on a number of those, but there's still a pretty significant number, and we're estimating between 200 and 300 of those types of cases come to us every year. But to put that burden back on the counties is not necessarily something that is music to their ears, and we would hope that if the sentencing guidelines are adjusted downward for certain offenses, or more people are released under community supervision with some strategy, we would hope that the resources would follow those initiatives as well. Simply dumping cases out and expecting somebody else to pick up the pieces is not responsible government.
Senator Sharon.
I have a number of questions, but I would like, I would like whomever would like to, I think Mr. Solheid, or Deputy Commissioner Solheid, perhaps you would be best to talk about what is a trend in cities to pass legislation restricting placement of persons leaving the correction systems in their community. How do you see that, and what you think we should be concerned about at the state level about how cities are exercising their authority in this area.
Senator Letts.
Commissioner Solheid.
Senator Sharon. There are approximately 19 cities now that have residency restrictions or zoning restrictions that essentially focus on eliminating housing options for sex offenders, primarily level three sex offenders. It is extremely difficult for us and for our agents, as well as the community corrections agents, to do their job in supervising these offenders when they don't have a stable residence in which to reside. Being able to hook them up to electronic monitoring or GPS requires usually a phone line and a place where we can check on them where we know they need to be. So the residency restrictions there are many national studies, as well as our own studies that have been done within the Department of Corrections, indicate that they are not effective at reducing in enhancing safety. They actually do the opposite or have the opposite effect, because it prevents law enforcement and corrections from effectively supervising these individuals when we don't have a stable residence. We are seeing more cities looking at residency restrictions. Part of their fear, it seems, is driven by the civilly committed sex offenders that are currently in St. Peter and MSOP, and concerns that they have that these offenders will at some point in time also be released.
Senator Sherman.
Thank you. Has there been any consultation with the League of Minnesota Cities about this issue, and an effort to try to inform city councils of the facts as opposed to being responsive to fear?
Commissioner Solheim. Senator Sherman, was that a rhetorical question? Or was that
slightly. So I'll set that aside. But I would like to ask a second question. Facts don't seem to make much difference in this discussion around how to deal with sex offenders. So. It was rhetorical. The other question I have is about the sentencing of persons to jail time on a first offense. You were talking about you're trying to reduce that as a way of reducing the pressure on the number of units that you need to house offenders. I'm curious about that. In the sentencing guidelines, is that a departing then from the sentencing guidelines when that occurs? And if it is, are you able to look at those numbers at some time in the future and let me know if there is what disparities there might be in who that population is in terms of race?
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sherman, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission produces a very comprehensive report that very specifically answers those departure questions. And in some instances, there is disparity by race. In some instances, the ones that you might expect, some drug offense, zero criminal history, the actual departures downward are non-white cases, but it's a beautiful report that answers almost any question you can ask about sentencing, the judicial district, the types of offenses, and the number of people sentenced in each category, and the number of departed in each category by sex, race. Age is not in there, but sex and race for sure. And it is presented to you folks annually.
Yeah, this is just
and I think it was just distributed last month. So it is online with the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And it's one of the best reports that I think is produced in the state.
Senator Goodwin.
Oh, thank you. I'm just wondering what your pre-release program looks like for people with mental illness and chemical dependency.
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Senator, could you repeat that question one more time for me?
Sure. Commissioner, I was wondering what you do for people with that you know in the prison have mental illness and chemical dependency, or one or the other, on pre-release planning.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, I am going to summon Nanette Larson, who is in charge of both of those considerations. In addition to physical health, Director Larson also is in charge of our mental health and treatment capabilities.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, a couple of thoughts for you. As you probably know, we have a number of release planners who devote their time to those offenders who have severe and persistent mental illness. And they start working with the offender population about 6 months prior to release. Because they're working with them, though, doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get out early. So we don't really have an early release program for them, but we do have this comprehensive release planning. And those comprehensive release plans will include everything from housing to follow-up appointments in the community with both psychiatrists as well as primary therapists. It will include medication. It will include financial assistance, whatever they might need, clothing, whatever they might need. We also have release planners dedicated to offenders who are completing our CD programming, because we know that that will also help to reduce recidivism. And they act in a very similar capacity. So they develop those very comprehensive release plans that include, in the case of CD treatment, aftercare resources, whether it's AA or some other kind of treatment programming, and then housing and financial assistance and clothing and whatever they might need.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Goodman,
just one more follow-up question. Well, actually, I have two. But one is, you know, I visited Shakopee in the fall, and I was impressed with the mental health program that you have there. And I know when I've talked before about CD treatment within the whole prison system, we've talked about how few people really get that CD treatment. And could you give me an idea of how many people that in the prison have a chemical dependency problem, and how many actually take advantage or have the ability to go through the CD program?
Mr. Chair and Larson. Senator Goodwin, I sure can tell you. We are, the Department of Corrections is the state's largest chemical dependency treatment provider. We have well over 900 residential CD treatment beds. Having said that, however, about 90% of our population is either diagnosed with a chemical dependency or chemical abuse, so we truly have a need. In 2014, there were 3,877 newly committed offenders who were assessed for CD treatment. Of those, 81% were directed to treatment. So a good portion. Almost 1,200 offenders entered treatment, and then of those, 76% successfully participated in treatment. So we're getting a pretty good chunk of them.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some general figures I was hoping to get while we have the Department of Corrections in front of us. Commissioner, could you tell me how many individuals are incarcerated by a Department of Corrections, the ones that are in prison?
Slightly over 10,000 right now.
And then those that are on a felony-level supervised release, about 20,000?
Well, probation and supervised release, there are about 40,000 offenders on probation and supervised release at a felony level. About 30,000 misdemeanors and 30,000 gross misdemeanors. Now, that's probation and supervised release on the felons, though. The supervised release population is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 to 6,000, I believe, statewide currently. I'd have to double-check our probation survey to get you that exact number.
Okay, and then there's a lot of discussion. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. There's a lot of discussion in the news these days about focusing our attention on the high proportion of minority inmates in prison. I hear figures all over the board, but I think it's more figures in different corners of the country rather than in Minnesota. Could you tell me what our minority population is in, let's say, incarcerated or supervised release, what that percentage might be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, about half of our inmates in prison are non-white, and that translates into the community as well. Of those in prison, 53% white, 34% black, 9% American Indian, 2.5% Asian, and the balance being unknown.
Okay. And I would imagine that,
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, that I would imagine that probably is somewhat the same proportion on those that are on supervised releases.
That would be my presumption, but we can certainly get you that.
I don't need to have that detail. That's all I need.
Clearly, it's a significant disparity.
Yeah, I know, Mr. Chair, that
I
have heard figures from other parts of the country that are saying 70% and other higher figures for minority populations. I have no accounting for why that is, or maybe Minnesota doesn't have the same general population concentrations as other urban or states with more of an urban concentration, but it is significant.
Senator Dietzick, and then we're going to have to wrap this up.
I have just a quick question of, can we get the list of cities? I think you said there are 19 communities that have said they will not take, or they've done zoning changes or some type of changes to prohibit people coming there after a release from prison.
Commissioner Solhead.
Chairman Letts, Senator Dijic, we can get you that list of those with residency restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Senator Sharon, very briefly.
My final question. We do get a lot of these reports that you've described, Commissioner, that come from the department, like the report from the sentencing guidelines that we briefly had a conversation with a group last week. But as is true on the Child Protection Task, Child Protection sends out a report every year. It just reports out numbers, and I'm curious to know if there is a process after the report is made in which somebody looks at that and draws trends and conclusions and gives more direction through that to the legislature. Just, we have a lot of reports that come in, and unless there's somebody taking that report in the department, pulling out such things as increasing disparity in who is incarcerated, changes in the number of people that are jailed without a prior conviction, and then what that looks like, what that might mean for us, so that we can understand what we might need to do for reform.
No response necessary? Or
no, I just hope if that's not done, I think we need that in all of these reports. Is somebody has to do more than just report out numbers. There has to be some analysis and conclusion that comes. What is it telling us? And how should it inform us for policy direction?
Certainly seek more information from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission as well. Any comment on that, Commissioner Roy?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we will work closely with your research staff. There are some comments in the executive, and it's weaved into with the numbers, and it's tough to glean out, but I will encourage the Guidelines Commission to make very clear those trends that should be of importance, and I'll bring it up at the next meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, next meeting is Thursday, February 12th. We're going to discuss four DWI-related bills. Don't anticipate any specific action on them. They'll be laid over for possible inclusion in a broader DWI package this year. And we'll consider a bill to make all statutory default misdemeanor penalties into petty misdemeanors. Again, probably no action on that bill, but this will set the table for action down the road. With that, members, we are adjourned.